the Ahlul Bayt, the divinely appointed imams, they point towards this idea that one should take yourself into account before you are taken account of. Of course, what they're talking about is it is better for us to take ourselves into account in this life before Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Mighty, the Exalted, takes us into account on the Day of Judgment. Of course, a very important thing that we must do, taking ourselves into account. Because this taking ourselves into account, dear friends, is in reality a door towards the secrets of ubudiyyah, the secrets of the servitude of Allah. In the next segments, we're going to talk about some verses of the Holy Quran, the words of Allah, which tell us to take ourselves into account. And of course, when we take ourselves into account, we will be able to enjoy and enhance and really feel the satisfaction and pleasure of the servitude and worship and ubudiyyah of Allah. Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
Sometimes the environment also plays a major role in the shedding of the tears. In which way? We are told, for example, that if you are in a masjid, yes, if you are in a place of worship, if you are in sajda, for example, if you are in a holy place, a mausoleum like the holy Kaaba or the shrines of the Ma'sumeen, peace be upon them, all this potentiates the ability to cry and to shed the tears. Likewise, the remembrance of death. I tell you, once here in the United States, rather, I was finishing a majlis and one young brother, 17, 18 year old, came to me and said, "You know, I have a problem." I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "You know, I cannot hold myself from the temptations. That when I go to school, there are people of the opposite gender, yes, and I fall into temptations. Teach me a way that I can say no to the desires." I said, "There is no magic pill. Don't expect, but work hard, but start off with the following." He said, "What should I do?" I said, "Go to your local Qabristan cemetery and find an empty grave and lie there for half an hour." So he went, he was lying there for half an hour, and I said to him, "Close your eyes and reflect. What would you do if it was too late? If in that actual act that displeases Allah, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala decided to take your life, there is no return. Whatever you do, if you beg, قَالَ رَبِّ ارْجِعُونَ, the Quran says they beg, "Ya Allah, return me back for a minute or two. Give me a chance. Everything in this life has a chance. You lose your business, you lose your health, maybe you can get it back. But once you leave this world, there is no return." I said to him, "Think about it." He came to me after a few days and said, "You know what? When I was lying there, I was shaking in fear. I could not lie there for half an hour, 5 minutes, and I stood out. I could not. I looked around me and I was petrified. And I thought to myself, what answers would I give to the angels? How would I face Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the Day of Judgment with my deeds, with my sins, with my transgressions?" Yes. And that's why our fourth imam beautifully in Dua Abu Hamza, he says, "Ma li la abki wa ara nafsi tukhadi'uni wa ayyami tukhatiluni." Imam alayhi salam says, "How dare I not cry and I see my days are being numbered. I'm getting closer to death. وَقَدْ خَفَقَتْ أَجْنِحَةُ الْمَوْتِ that عند رأسي أجنحة الموت. Death is approaching to me. I can feel it. The wings of death are right next to me. Don't tell me you're only 18 or 19. That death comes at any moment. Imam Ali Salam says, feel that it's as if it's coming to you. And then he says, Mali la abki, abki li zulmati qabri, abki li dhiqi lahdi, abki li su'ali munkarin wa nakirin iyai. Should I not cry about any of these realizations that I'm by myself in the grave, that it's dark, that it's tight, that I have to answer to Munkar and Nakir? Should I not be crying by the realization that then when the cry is heard, I will be resurrected and I will be all alone? I will be carrying my deeds unclothed. No one is concerned about me. Everyone's concerned about their own well-being on the day of resurrection. Therefore, a powerful way to keep ourselves in that zone, or to be able to cry due to the fear or the awe or be God conscious, is to indeed remember the ultimate journey of death, the universal law that no doubt applies to each and every human being.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were saying, which of course was taking ourselves into account, and how taking ourselves into account is a door towards the secrets of the worship and servitude of Allah, the ubudiyyah of Allah. Now, when we take ourselves into account, what happens is that the evil things that we have done, the bad things that we have done, the sins that we have committed, the errors we might have committed, the mistakes that we might have committed, these negative things, if we just call them in general, all of them together, these negative things are taken into account. Once we take these negative things into account, then we do our best to refrain from doing those things, and we analyze and we reflect and we contemplate and we figure out how to prevent ourselves from doing these things in the future. And likewise, we ask for forgiveness from Allah. Now, on the other hand, the good deeds that we have done, the noble and honorable and righteous things that we have done, the things that we have done that are satisfactory and acceptable when it comes to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, these things, we look at them and we reflect and we contemplate, and then we find ways to continue to do these good things. And at the same time, we thank Allah that Allah is the one who gave us the blessings to be able to do these good things. Now, when talking about the words of Allah, when it comes to taking ourselves into account, we find in Suratul Kahf, which is the chapter of the cave, chapter number 18, verse number 49. Again, chapter number 18, verse number 49, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and they shall find present what they have done. Allahu Akbar. In this verse, dear friends, how clearer can it be said? And in another verse of the Holy Quran, we have Surah Zilzal. This is chapter Zilzal, chapter number 99, verse number 7. Again, chapter number 99, verse number 7, where Allah says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, so he who has done an atom's weight of good shall see it. Allahu Akbar. Another clear verse of the Holy Quran telling us that accounting of ourselves will occur. So why not take ourselves into account, clear the ledger, and move towards Allah?
السلام عليك يا أسير القربات السلام عليك يا
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
السلام عليك يا أسير الكربات ويا قتيل العبرايات أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب السلام على الخد التريب السلام على الرأس المرفوع
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio today, we have with us Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
So today we have a very interesting and intricate topic to be discussing, inshallah. To open up the discussion, I'd like to ask Sayyid Shahriar to shed some light on the JCPOA. And, you know, this is, the world does view it as between USA and Iran. Whose fault was it for leaving? I mean, I have a feeling which way this conversation is going to go, which direction it's going to take.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, just a little bit of a background on this JCPOA. So this is a agreement that was done by multiple countries. It was not just the United States. So the countries involved, they're also called the P5+1, mm-hmm. right? So you have the United States, Britain, France, Russia, China. This is the P5. And then plus one is Germany. And, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran. So this is a nuclear deal that took a couple of years to come to fruition. It was quite difficult. But all of the parties, they signed this JCPOA, which pretty much the crux of the matter was that sanctions will be lifted from the Islamic Republic of Iran in exchange for certain limitations upon their nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this is the background. Of course, very quickly, so this JCPOA occurred during the Obama administration, which includes the current president, who was then vice president, Joseph Biden. These guys, they made the deal, right? And then when Donald Trump came in as the next president, he called it a lousy deal, and he left the deal, right, unilaterally, without the consent of any of the other partners, and which, of course, is, you know, the United Kingdom and France and Germany and Russia and China. So this kind of shows you this kind of very one-sided mentality of the United States of America. Go it alone. We don't care about anybody else, even if you are our own friends. So, yes, United States of America was the country that decided to one-sided, unilaterally leave the JCPOA.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, Sheikh Ali, what do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, as Sayyid beautifully summarized here, JCPOA is an agreement between the world's so-called superpowers and the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is definitely a regional power, to say the least, and inshallah on its way to becoming that superpower and have a very serious role in the entire world dynamics. So the idea was because of the fame and popularity of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its notions, its human-based principles, which they were and have been standing on, they tried to contain the Islamic Republic and its development and its progress. And what did they use to contain the Islamic Republic? It was this deal. It's called JCPOA, which is also known as Barjam in Farsi. And, you know, the purpose of this deal was to really contain the progress and development of the Islamic Republic of Iran when it comes to its nuclear enrichment program. Now, for our listeners, you know, one thing has to be very clear, that there are two things that need to be understood. One is nuclear enrichment, which is the right of every nation, and the other is nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the right of none, and because of its collateral damage.
Right, and nuclear enrichment is the same as nuclear energy?
It's the nuclear energy, right?
Okay.
So you enrich uranium to get to a certain level where it converts into energy, which can be then used for the betterment of the society and the development of nations and countries. Now, this is a right of every nation to enrich uranium so mm-hmm. they can fulfill their needs when it comes to energy.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to nuclear weapons, it's an entirely different ballgame. You enrich uranium to a point where you turn it into weapons, mm-hmm. and these are the weapons of mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And who has it? only a select few countries in the world have it. Mm-hmm. And who has used it? It's only the United States of America who has used it.
Only one country that's used it.
Right? Mm. So this weapon program is an issue which, according to Islam, as the leader of the Islamic Republic and the leader of the Muslim Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, it is haram, it is forbidden to attain and to make and to possess and to use these weapons, Islamically speaking. So the Islamic Republic of Iran was never, is not, and will not be pursuing the nuclear weapons,
right,
which the West has it, right? Israel has it, right? Without signing the NPT even, right? Islamic Republic, in principle, is against this whole acquisition of these weapons because of the nature of these weapons and how they cause the collateral damage. And it, you remember Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
So Islamic Republic is against acquiring those weapons, but Islamic Republic is adamant and is insistent, and rightly so, for the acquisition of nuclear energy,
right,
which is a right of every nation. So they want to contain Iran, contain its progress, contain its development, and hence they came up with this so-called deal, which is the JCPOA, so that nuclear program stops. And why do they not want Iran to acquire it? Just very quickly, last point.
Acquire nuclear energy.
Energy. Mm. Because they don't want to see an Islamic Iran which is independent.
Mm.
They want dependency. The West wants dependency. And they want Iran to be subjugated to the West and look towards the West when it comes to fulfilling their own needs.
Yeah, if it's self-sufficient, then it no longer has any need for the West.
Exactly.
So,
It's very interesting, this point that Sheikh Ali brought up about nuclear energy, right? So in one of the recent speeches from the month of February, I think, towards the end of February, the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he has a very interesting point where he brings this up. So he says that at the current time, the West is buying barrel after barrel of oil at an incredibly cheap price. I mean, they're pretty much their you know, bottled water is more expensive than the oil that is being sold to Western countries in today's time. Okay? And oil, I believe it was Henry Kissinger, he said that if you control the oil, you control the governments. So they're controlling the governments based upon Henry Kissinger's. He was Secretary of State in one of the United States government, very famous guy.
He's one of the think tanks.
Yeah, one of those very famous. And so he said if you control the oil, you control the governments. And so now we find that they are not only controlling the oil, but the governments at a very, very cheap price. So after this, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, right, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, he says that, but if these countries, for example, France or Germany or the United States or the UK, if they were oil producers, they wouldn't even sell us this same oil bottle by bottle, right? So he's saying we're selling it to these guys barrel by barrel. And if it was them, the ones who were producing oil, they wouldn't even sell it to us bottle by bottle.
And they do it, right? Look at the technology, right?
Mm-hmm.
There are certain bans on technologies that, for instance, Iranians are not allowed to pursue.
Yeah.
Right? They do it.
Yeah.
This is the nature of the West. But yeah, it's a...
Yeah, bottle by bottle, right? And so then after that, he says, and this is the vision of this leader, a vision that you do not see in any other so-called Muslim governments or Muslim leaders in other parts of the Muslim world. He very clearly says, and this is from last month, February's speech, he says that nuclear energy is the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they do not want us to be able to have our own nuclear energy, right? And he says, why? It's just like the oil. So what they want to do is to be able to control nuclear energy and then in the future, you know, charge us an arm and a leg for this very same nuclear energy that, as Sheikh Ali said, it should be free for all. It is the right for all nations. So a very interesting thing on nuclear energy.
There's really the dependence on the West, right? They don't want to see any nation to be independent, let alone the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is standing on human principles, right?
Right.
They don't want to see an Islamic Iran, which is independent, and that's what it boils down to.
Inshallah, let's continue with this thought on dependency, because they want us to be economically dependent on America and the West. They want us to be dependent in other ways too, right?
Yeah, technologically dependent in terms of our food needs, in terms of the energy need, in terms of our well-being. You know, let it be vaccines right now. Mm-hmm. They're pushing hard for us to just go and get their vaccines, what they are developing. No matter how flawed those vaccines are, no matter how untested those vaccines are, why are they pushing for it?
Yeah.
Well, they're pushing simply not because they want to help any nation, let alone the nation of the Islamic Republic of Iran. They are pushing so the other nations are dependent on them. And this is one thing that Islam has taught us, right? Islam, even at a very individual level, at a very singleton level, Islam has pushed for independency, right? Islam doesn't want to see beggars on the street asking other people for their livelihood. Islam doesn't want to see these small little setups to be dependent on the bigger setups, right? Islam doesn't want to see these small countries, the third world countries, to be dependent on the so-called superpowers, right? Islam has taught us the lesson of integrity, dignity, independence, right? Self-sufficiency, depending on your own abilities, depending on your own resources, depending on your own people. You know, this is a message for the governments of the world, especially the governments of the third world countries, that you are expected and supposed to be independent. You have to be depending on your own strengths and your own people. And this is the message of the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Imam Sayyid Ali Khamenei. One of the things that I see with Iran is, and it's really fascinating, how they believe in empowering other nations. See, when West comes to help any nation, their model is to make them dependent, more dependent and more dependent, right?
Yes, yes.
So they're like, you know, completely controlled, manipulated, and their resources are looted and used. But when it comes to the Islamic Republic helping other nations, it is beautiful, right? They try to empower that nation.
Yeah.
You have seen it in case of Syria. You have seen it in case of Iraq. You have seen it in case of Yemen. You are seeing it as a matter of fact, right? Palestine, for instance, right? It's not that Iran sent like all of these military men and, you know, fighter jets and everything to Palestine. No, they said you are going to determine your own fate. Right, you have to stand tall on your feet against the oppressors and aggressors. And yes, we will help if you want to stand up. Right, this is empowerment. Right, this is way different than you know, looking at another nation as if, oh, now they're stuck, so let's just abuse them, misuse them, and, you know, control them.
You know, it's funny that you. It's really interesting, actually, that you mentioned dependency even when it comes to food, because America, one of their plans is to control world food, isn't it? Through these big corporations. There's actually a hadith that I heard just yesterday from Imam Sadiq. He said that one who worries about his sustenance has actually sinned. It's a form of sinning to worry about your sustenance of today or tomorrow, right? And it just goes to show you that Islam really does want people to be independent, because it's through fear that they actually control people. It's through fear that you won't be able to provide for yourself, fear that you won't be able to produce your own energy, your own food. I don't know if you've heard, Sayed, about Henry Kissinger's 1974 plan.
No, go ahead.
There was a classified 200-page study in which the study falsely claimed that population growth in so-called lesser developed countries was a grave threat to U.S. national security.
Right.
So since then, they've been plotting to actually stop the growth, the population growth in other countries, and food has a major role to play with it.
Yeah, I don't know if you, I don't think we have too much time on the program, but if our listeners, they do a little bit of research on, for example, companies such as Monsanto and genetically modified seeds that can only be bought by companies, and there are seeds that do not reproduce other plants, a very interesting thing to research. But one thing that I think is important is this cultural dependency as well, that the West is trying to create all over the world, where it is their culture that needs to be implemented across the globe, whether it's their music or it's their ethics, their morality, their philosophies, their everything. Also a very dangerous thing cultural dependency upon the West.
Yeah. They wish for other countries, especially Iran, to be dependent on them in various different ways. Nuclear energy is one of them. Food is one of them. Just very quickly, America actually adopted as official policy in November 1975 by President Gerald Ford this food control, this population control. It outlined a covert plan to reduce population growth in those countries through birth control and also implicitly war and famine. That's all we have time for today. Inshallah, next time we're going to be talking about the JCPOA more and delving deeper into the psyche behind this whole phenomenon. From myself, from Sayyid Mahdi, and from Sheikh Ali, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is Viewpoints coming to you from IRIB English Radio.
You're the reason my life's worth living. You're the reason I'm alive. I'd be lost without you. You're the reason that I strive. You're my destiny. You're my revenue.
Aperture.
The birth and development of the American police can be traced to a multitude of historical, legal, and political economic conditions. The institution of slavery and the control of minorities, however, were two of the more formidable historic features of American society shaping early policing. Slave patrols and night watches, which later became modern police departments, were both designed to control the behaviors of minorities. Slave patrols helped to maintain the economic order and to assist the wealthy landowners in recovering and punishing slaves who essentially were considered property. Though many years have passed from the abolishment of slavery, police brutality is the enduring legacy of slavery in the U.S. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. In response to the sustained and increasingly visible violence against black communities in the U.S., the Black Lives Matter movement took shape. The movement campaigns against police violence and systematic racism towards African Americans. People from all walks of life in the Black Lives Matter campaign regularly protest police killings of black people and broader issues of racial profiling, police brutality, and racial inequality in the United States criminal justice system. Stay with us as this documentary talks to activists, specialists, and family members of police brutality victims to depict the true picture of systematic injustice and racism in the heart of American society. Don't go away. Here's the first part.
Eric Garner went unconscious.
Cops used a chokehold that allegedly led to Eric Garner's death.
And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever.
Medical examiner said Eric Garner.
Police say they arrested him after committing
stop wondering why. I was screaming at the TV.
Is his death not being called a homicide?
In a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes.
A Staten Island grand jury has decided not to indict an NYPD officer in the death of a man on Staten Island.
Thank you. Officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard. The protesters are basically right in their faces.
Protesters in Minneapolis have attempted to shut down the city's airport this afternoon. The group representing the Black Lives Matter movement blocked two roads outside a terminal before state police ordered the group to disperse. Back to the situation in downtown Los Angeles, looks like protesters have moved now onto the 101 freeway in downtown. Earlier in the day, organizers of the group promised that a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, black lives matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. And I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida. Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? One reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally profess, but it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured. If you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some policemen was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail, not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else of the upper class.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he was actually, he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us it appears as excessive, but for the officer at the given moment on the street it wasn't excessive, and the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, you know, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
Cigarettes.
Let's arrest them and have them go before a jury of his peers,
yeah.
And let's use the system the way it's supposed to be used. Cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens in the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands, they kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement, but there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her. Yeah.
She needs that assistance.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Garner in a chokehold. Garner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Garner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Garner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Garner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's all, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet, and would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why, you know. I was screaming at the TV. Because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes. And it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just... You know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow, I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes the roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have more fear probably than an average person, because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if black lives matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the black lives that are the last ones that have value.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is your host Musa al-Bahadili, and you are listening to IRIB English Radio. Today you are joining us for our program Islamic Upbringing, wherein we discuss problems, issues, questions parents have regarding the raising of their children in an Islamic way. All of the answers given in this program are based upon the Holy Quran and the narrations of the household of the Prophet, and of course the Prophet himself. Peace be upon them all. Joining us in our studio again is our dear friend and guest speaker, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sayyid, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sayyid. Our topic today, overall topic, is communication, which it has been for some programs now, but our more specific